Good day, beautiful people, and welcome to another episode of the Total Disclosure Podcast. Today on, we'll be discussing Inés Orrieta and, of course, Queen Máxima, the Dutch royal family, and we'll discuss a little bit about the Vatican and Pope Francis and the involvement they had with covering and even facilitating some of the crimes against humanity committed during the Dirty War in Argentina. Let's start with a little bit of translated material from an interview that I found in the Argentinian media. A cover-up of sorts, because it seems a biography was supposed to be published without any censorship. The real story of Máxima. It was written by journalist Soledad Ferrari and Gonzalo Alvarez Guerrero. They went through an extensive reedition, and the book was a popular sell in the country, as it synchronized with the announcement made by Queen Beatrix as she abdicated in favor of her son, which naturally would make Máxima the first queen born in Argentina in whole history. The book was originally published in 2008, and it shows an intimate depiction of the queen, who was born in a wealthy family from the ports over 40 years ago. The research was deep and relentless, to the point that the authors were threatened by the Dutch royal family, insisting consequences could affect the writers of Máxima, the most popular member of the Dutch royalty, even more popular than Queen Beatrix, according to Soledad Ferrari, one of the writers. Despite the threats, the journalists carried on and even launched a more extensive version in which they expose intel showcasing the links between the Orrietas and the characters who form part of the darkest period in recent Argentinian history. The Crown did their own research and managed to clean up almost everything that exposed Máxima, except of course the history of her father, which was internationally known already. She's much more than a smiling blonde princess, added the writer. However, these links are not the only shady relationships the Queen has developed across the years as an Argentinian socialite. The book reveals, for one, that the property Máxima bought in Pipilcura, Bariloche, is managed by her aunt, Marcela Cerruti, who lives with her current life partner, Claudia Méndez Casariego, the former daughter-in-law of Luciano Benjamín Menéndez, a ruthless war criminal who also served under Videla's regime and is arguably the most cruel of the members of that government. This family has never cut ties with the blackest history of the country. When Orrieta worked in the duty-free office, his partner was Ofelio Cabanillas, nephew of a very known human trafficker who sold babies during the regime. They're all friends, even with Blaquier, even when they try to deny the associations, adds the author, who also hints that there are family issues because of money. She grew up like that, like many people of her generation. He wasn't aware about most of the nefarious crimes committed during the Dirty War. She wasn't aware about most of the nefarious crimes committed during the Dirty War, and it was until recently, when her father's issues became public again, that she met with the Stella de Carlotto and offered to help the victims. But in the end, nothing was done. The book, published by Sudamericana, states that the Queen Máxima of the Netherlands is not the mother aristocrat or the intrepid and adventurous horse rider, not even the brilliant economist like the official version has sold it to the people. She's just another human, like the rest of us, without any special skills but her bloodline and her last name. During this interview, the writers also reveal that the investigation lasted for 2 years, And it was very difficult to finish because of the threats done by the Dutch crown. And, you know, it's also a matter of not demonizing Maxima. They describe her as a fun girl, not the best student, very noisy in class, and who lacked a good relationship with her mother. She cursed a lot. A very normal girl, you could say. Her spontaneous nature and quirky sense of humor is what allegedly conquered the prince's heart, and Queen Beatrix herself. Beatrix has been quoted as saying that Maxima is the daughter that she never had. Maxima asked everybody to avoid talking to the writers. The public relations, media, and protocol chief of the Dutch crown called the writers to say they were taking them to court. That never happened, and so they continued to gather testimonies from family, friends, teachers, and classmates. They built a family history. For example, Maxima was raised by a single mom. Because her parents were never married, they simply had an affair. Maxima's mother, Maria del Carmen Cerruti, Caricar, was Jorge Zorrilleta's secretary, and they were able to get married until Jorge managed to get divorced. In the book, you can read how Maxima was trained by the queen herself, learned how to portray her virtues and to hide her past, so she could move to the castle and enjoy a family net worth calculated in almost 5 billion euros, but at the same time lining up with the rigid protocols of the crown. Maxima is described as an adult as ambitious, very smart, very Latin, friendly and warm. In the end, I don't know how honest this book turned out to be, because her family in Argentina actually read it and they liked it, so I don't know how many details this book has of their childhood or even when their father used to work for the Videla regime. It is also revealed that the fact that her father cannot attend any official event to be by her side hurts her a lot, always hurt her. And every time that her father used to visit her in Netherlands, she often received a slight by the queen or even her husband. That's one of the few things that it's noticed, that it's obvious for most people. There is this rejection of her father, and that has been since day one, apparently. And, you know, how far these people go to maintain an image, because, yes, Jorge was probably a scumbag. And, you know, if he was in charge of the video gallery, of these blackmail tapes, of these poor women, and I believe even boys, being raped by elites, Videla had to trust him. And for someone like Videla to trust you, it means that you paid your dues. And paying your dues for someone like Videla, that's no less than killing. So at the very least, we can suppose that Jorge was a killer. At least in my opinion, that's my reasoning. The wedding was very hard for the queen. Even though I have a natural disdain for the monarchy and people who, you know, live in a whole different universe than us, the Gentiles, one cannot judge where these people are born. And, you know, by checking out Dolores Art, my publication on Patreon and also Facebook, if we are to believe the official reports, we would believe that Maxima and the Pope met for the first time in 2013, only after the Pope's inauguration, when she and her husband were present at the ceremony. They then met in 2016 during a private visit and during the official state visit in 2017. The video footage of the state visit in 2017 shows that the faces of Maxima and Pope Francis actually light up when they see each other again. This seems to be an indication that the two have known each other for a much longer time and much better than the government information agency wants us to believe. Moreover, Maxima studied at the Catholic University in Buenos Aires, where Jorge Bergoglio was on the board at the time. The fact that the two have known each other for much longer is also apparent from the monthly donations that Maxima would have donated to the Pope in 2008 for a Catholic TV channel in Argentina. According to Noticias magazine, Maxima would have donated the Pope $15,000 a month in that period and a total of 128,000 euros, around $200,000 at the time, if that money came from the monthly allowance that the princess received from the Dutch treasury at the time, she would have had very little of it remaining. Apparently, the government information service had the affair in their stomachs because they refrained from commenting because it would be a private matter. The media tried to launder the affair by declaring it as a non-journalistic message. The article came from the journalist Maria Fernanda, who claimed that her article was indeed based on reliable sources. Apparently, the editorial staff of the newspapers initially thought it was a substantiated claim, because various newspapers took over the message about the donations. In addition, it is striking that many of these articles have since been removed from the media archives. Bergoglio was a good friend of the Sorrigueta family. Bergoglio is said to have played an active role in the disappearance of the 30,000 political opponents during the Videla regime, although Jorge Sorrigueta has also been discredited due to his involvement in these human rights violations. He was never convicted of it, regardless of whether he personally contributed to the political killings and disappearances. He is in any case responsible for his position as minister in the Videla cabinet, complicit at best and married participant at worst. According to Kevin, Maxima had an affair with Jorge Bergoglio. He also could have been her handler. He was a friend of the family. She was much younger. When she married William Alexander, the media denied she had ever met the Pope. When you look at the video of the official meeting, you'll see what we're talking about. Ex-General Jorge Videla said he had many conversations with Argentina's Cardinal Raúl Francisco Prima Testa about his regime's dirty war against left-wing activists. He said there were also conversations with other leading bishops from Argentina's Episcopal Conference, as well as with the country's papal nuncio at the time, Pio Laghi. "They advised us about the manner in which to deal with the situation," said Videla in a series of interviews conducted by the magazine El Sur in 2010, but published a few years later. He said that in certain cases, church authorities offered their good offices and undertook to inform families looking for the disappeared relatives to desist from their searches, but only if they were certain the families would not use the information to denounce the junta. In the case of families that it was certain would not make political use of the information, they told him not to look any more for their child because he was dead, Videla confessed. He said the church understood well and also assumed the risks of such involvement. The confession, if truthful, confirms long-held suspicions that Argentina's Catholic hierarchy collaborated with the military's so-called process of national reorganization, which sought to root out communism. In the years following the 1976 coup, led by Videla, thousands of left-wing activists were swept into secret detention centers where they were tortured and even murdered. Military chaplains were assigned as spiritual advisors to the junior officers who staffed the centers. There is at least one criminal case where Francis was implicated in handing over six individuals to be disappeared, including two rival priests. Argentine human rights lawyer Marcelo Parrilli brought Bergoglio's case to the authorities, accusing him of implication in the kidnapping. That was in April 2005, shortly before the conclave that eventually chose Joseph Ratzinger to become Pope Benedict XVI. Bergoglio reportedly got the second most votes, but stepped aside in deference to Ratzinger. A Jesuit spokesman called Parrilli's legal complaint slander. Bergoglio twice used his right to refuse to give evidence in court when he testified in 2010. His comments were evasive, according to human rights lawyer Miriam Breckman. In 2012, Argentine bishops collectively apologized for the mistakes of the church in the country's dirty war in the 1970s and early 80s, more than 30 years after the fact. After their detainment, Giorgio and Jalix were offered reinstatement into the Jesuit order. Jalix accepted, but Giorgio did not. Giorgio never fully recovered from the traumatic experiences in prison. He died in 2000 in Uruguay. Franz Jalix survived the difficult times of torture with the help of meditation and constant prayer. He traveled to Germany in 1978 and later wrote a book about spiritual retreats. He declined to comment on the matter, but he's at peace with Bergoglio, quote. Jesuit spokesman Thomas Busch said, a few years ago, Father Jalix traveled to Buenos Aires on the invitation of the Archbishop, and they talked. Nothing is known of their conversation, of course. I can't believe it. I'm so distressed and full of anger that I don't know what to do, wrote the sister of deceased priest and torture victim Orlando Giorgio in an email to the journalist Orazio Berbitsky. Now he's achieved what he wanted. He, for Graciela Giorgio, refers to a power-hungry man who betrayed her brother and the Hungarian Jesuit Franz Jalix to Argentina's military dictatorship. A man who did nothing to stop the two faithful from being locked up in prison for 5 months and torture. He is Pope Francis, then still known as Jorge Mario Bergoglio, provincial of the Argentine Jesuits. While much of Argentina celebrates the election of their countryman, Jorge Mario Bergoglio as the Pope, others accuse him of having played a dovish role in Argentina's military dictatorship. There are prominent voices on both sides of the debate. So all of this begs the question, what does the Nazi past of Prince Bernhard, Project Paperclip, the Argentinian region of Bariloche, and Queen Maxima have to do with each other? What role did the Pope, the Sorreguetas, and the Dutch royalty play in the human rights violations and the laundering of crimes, which took place both during the Second World War and during the Dirty War in Argentina? 5 international judges representing the International Common Law Court of Justice in Brussels examined evidence of child rape, torture, murder, and kidnapping allegedly done by global elite members of the Ninth Circle Satanic Child Sacrifice Cult Network. Regular Ninth Circle child sacrifices were said to take place in the catacombs of Catholic cathedrals, the Vatican, on private states and groves, and government military bases in Belgium, Netherlands, Spain, Australia, Ireland, France, England, and the United States. At least 34 child mass grave sites were identified in Ireland, Spain, and Canada, and refused excavation by their respective governments, Crown of England, and the Catholic Church. Anglican, United Church of Canada, and the Catholic Church officials, including cardinals, members of European royalty, including Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip, officials of the Canadian, Australian, UK, and US military and governments, including the USA's CIA, plus prominent government ministers, judges, politicians, and businessmen from all these countries participated. Teens were drugged, stripped, naked, raped, hunted down in the woods, and killed by European royals, according to this latest witness to testify before the International Common Law Court in Brussels. The woman was the fourth eyewitness to give accounts about these human hunting parties of the global elite Nine Circle Satanic Child Sacrifice Cult Network. Now, if you remember Jimmy Savile, which is often called the most prolific pedophile in the United Kingdom history, he was a member of the Nine Circle Satanic Child Sacrifice Cult Network. And I don't know specifically if this is a Jesuit order. I believe it is. But this is where you see that it doesn't matter. All these secret societies, nobility, royalty, they all join together when it's time to do sacrifices. You know, when it's time to do rituals and kill some people, they're all friends. A former member of the Netherlands criminal drug syndicate known as Octopus testified that victims were obtained for these human hunting parties from juvenile detention centers in Belgium and Holland. Quote, in 2004, I was an involuntary witness to torture, rape, and murder sessions of drugged children performed for a group of high-ranked people of the Netherlands, stated a woman. She declared that she was taken to a hunting party in Belgium, close to Brussels, where she saw two boys and a girl, ages 14 to 16, hunted and killed by the global elites. The human hunting party was heavily guarded by the Netherlands Royal Guards. She was told that King Albert of Belgium was present. Four eyewitnesses confirmed that as children and adolescents, they were forced to attend human hunting parties where they and other children were raped, with some killed, and deceased boys' penises were cut off and displayed as trophies. Allegedly, there was a Dutch countryside palace where boys' penises were displayed like trophies on the wall, like if there were deers. Some hunting parties were hosted on the grounds of the Netherlands, inside the property of Queen Beatrix, even. Dutch therapist Toos Nijenhua claimed that as a 4-year-old, she was forced to witness murders of children that involved former Pope Ratzinger, a Dutch Catholic cardinal, plus the father of Netherlands Queen Beatrix, and Bilderberg founder, Dutch Crown Prince Alfred Bernhard. I saw the former Pope Joseph Ratzinger murder a little girl, another witness confirmed. It was at a French chateau in the fall of 1987. It was ugly, horrible, and didn't happen just once. Ratzinger and Bernhard were some of the more prominent men who took part in the sacrifice. In Ireland, Spain, and Canada, as mentioned before, 34 child mass grave sites were discovered and appeared linked to Ninth Circle activities. The largest one was the Mohawk Indian Residential School in Brantford, Ontario, where child remains were identified in 2008 before the Catholic Church, Canadian government, and English Crown shut down the dig by professional archaeologists. The 2013 ICLCJ court had found Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip guilty for the October 10, 1964 disappearance of 10 native children from the Catholic residential school in Kamloops, British Columbia. In the first 2 weeks of the 2014, court witnesses identified Dutch and Belgian royal participants in the rape and killing of Mohawk children and newborns. Named were Bernhard and King Hendrik, consort to Queen Wilhelmina of Holland. Alleged to be present during the human hunting parties was the late Prince Johan Friso and his wife Mabel Wiss Smith, former ministers, the top man of the Dutch army, the secretary, the vice president next to Queen Beatrix, and other global business and political leaders, including some from the United States. They do nothing about it, quote, unlikely are the ones to stop investigations and prosecutions. The story came on the internet after years of trying to move the police and justice department in the Netherlands to act against the criminals, one of the witnesses said. Nobody did anything to stop these criminals, probably because Queen Beatrix and King Albert likely interfere with the investigations. In January 2014, the brother of the King of Holland, Prince Johan Friso, passed away in a coma after these revelations were published in 3 different languages online. It's also worth mentioning that both Prince Bernhard and Pope Joseph Ratzinger were Nazi sympathizers during World War II. The ICLCJ court received a collection of Jesuit archival records about a child sacrificial cult known as the Knights of Darkness. In 1933, the Knights were established by the Catholic Jesuits and Nazi Waffen SS division. The records showed that Ratzinger was identified as a member of the Knights while working as an SS chaplain's assistant at the Ravensbrück concentration camp in Germany. The record also stated that Ratzinger participated in child sacrificial rites using kidnapped children from the camps or political prisoners. Another court document called the Magisterial Privilege indicated child sacrifice was a regular occurrence at the Vatican. At the tender age of 12, Esbali of San Diego County, California, claimed she was brought to the catacombs beneath the Vatican to witness the sacrifice of a 3-year-old drug boy. In the video in which Esbali is interviewed, the interviewer remembers that 24 years prior, a girl named Maria also told him that she witnessed another satanic child sacrifice rite in the very same Vatican catacombs. So, you know, decades apart, kids that young, you know, I don't think they're making that happen. It's gonna be on the same catacombs. And if you have seen the maps of the underground catacombs and rooms below the Vatican, it's humongous. It's astonishing. And I think there's like 7 main catacombs. To top all of this off, the Ireland police reported to the ICLCJ court that close to 800 babies were buried in a Catholic nun's septic tank, and these bodies were dismembered, decapitated, and in bits and pieces. All signs that they could have been murdered in satanic child sacrifice rites. Amnesty has been offered to citizens or employees of the Vatican, Crown of England, churches or governments willing to give sworn testimony or evidence that leads to the prosecution of those global elites suspected of committing crimes. Rewards up to 10,000 euros or around $14,000 were made available through the ICLCJ court alone. The ICLCJ court had over 450 common law peace officers in 13 countries, with 51 local chartered groups operating. And what about the Nazi ties of Prince Bernhard? Released documents from the FBI indicate that Hitler died in Argentina. Hitler and his beloved Eva Braun went to hide to Argentina after escaping via submarine, via the Vatican. He never committed suicide. Many books have been written about it. Countless articles have discussed how Hitler and other prominent Nazis went into hiding in Bariloche, Argentina. If we add this to Prince Bernhard's false war past and the fact that the Vatican also played a role in smuggling Nazi criminals to Argentina, the royal family's history is still very much affected. All these connections are not as accidental and innocent as they seem. Certainly not if we put it in a larger perspective, what happened during Project Paperclip, after the war, and during the dirty war in Argentina. It is generally known that both Prince Bernhard and Prince Klaus, the grandfather and father of the current king, had ties with the Nazis, but at the same time, this seems to have sunk deep in the collective memory. Prince Bernhard was a pre-war member of the Nazi Party, SS and SA. In fact, Prince Bernhard was Hitler's personal bodyguard and a member of the German Nazi Party, NSDAP. Prince Klaus was a member of the Hitlerjugend. In 1937, some people boycotted the wedding of Queen Juliana and the German Prince Bernhard after the Nazi Horst Wessel song was played in Bernhard's honor at a pre-wedding gala. Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands was the first president of the Bilderberg Group, which reportedly has Nazi links. In connection with the Dutroux affair, Regina Louf provided the names of top people who had abused her and who had murdered children during orgies. Reportedly, Regina Louf visited Prince Bernhard's yacht, the Jumbo 6. Moreover, both Prince Bernhard and Prince Klaus are mentioned by countless witnesses in connection with pedophilia and satanic abuse. There are many shocking revelations about the Dutch royal family, including witnesses Toos van Nijewa and Anne-Marie van Blijenburg, despite the gross allegations of human rights violations against the former head of state, Queen Beatrix, Prime Minister Ruth, and other influential persons, they have never openly defended themselves against these allegations. They just pretend they don't exist. The involvement of royal families in elite pedophile parties and satanic abuse was also demonstrated by 10 testimonies in the Dutroux case. The judicial system manipulates the image of the case, the perps, and the victims. By bringing out lying figures, or by suggesting that there was a perpetrator who acted practically alone, instead of a player within an international network, downplay, downsize the impact of the criminal network. They defend the acquittal of suspects, reconciliation, or they present a frontman as the culprit who must have done it. As long as the network remains unspoken, it doesn't matter who takes the fall. Large-scale abuse is dismissed as mass hysteria. Remember the McMartin preschool case? Remember the finders? The files on those two cases have been declassified. And turns out, intelligence lied to us all along. There were indeed underground tunnels connecting the McMartin preschool with churches and residences. And now we find that the finders were involved with the people from the McMartin preschool. So, you know, this keeps getting worse and worse. The disclosure, yes, it certainly helps humanity to turn the page, to heal, to change whatever this thing is that has corrupted us to the bone. One can deduce from this that powerful figures have a great deal of influence on both the media and the judiciary system. As a result, the true size of the network and the way in which all these things are interwoven in one way or another remains invisible for the general public. The power of the media is also evident from the positive image of the royal family that is constantly being displayed, weddings, parties, philanthropy. As a result, the true size of the network and the way in which the propaganda machine works over time to present them as often and positively as possible. Above all, a picture emerges of an extremely sympathetic and charming royal couple, in which it seems that the majority of people simply cannot look beyond the superficial outer appearance. Their contaminated family history and ties with dubious regimes should nevertheless be a reason to dig deeper into the real agenda of the royal family and the role it plays. Perhaps partly involuntarily. Who knows? It is bizarre that the mainstream media has never honestly reported on the role of the Oranges in the Bilderberg Group and how these types of secret clubs and secret societies influence the actual political agenda. Another tried and tested mean of putting pressure on politicians and top officials is blackmail, with compromising images of pedophile activity. Despite all the propaganda, the romantic fairy tale image of the royal family is starting to crumble. On TV, the royal family still seems to be as popular as ever, but when you talk to people in person on the street, there is a lot of criticism. There is a lot of comments that we don't need them anymore. Did we ever need them? The royal family is at least seen as a group of scrapers, tapping our tax pennies. Even people who are not yet aware of the larger picture behind the scenes, you know, child sacrifice and necrophilia and cannibalism and all of those petty things. The bizarre security measures that were taken in Amersfoort last King's Day also show that the family no longer feels as safe as years ago. It is no longer business as usual. More and more people see the world for what really is. People born into families such as the Sorreguietas and the Oranges often have little choice as to what role they should play in their lives. Despite all the riches, splendor, and pizzazz, they're living a straitjacket of obligations and protocols. Participation in dark rituals is not voluntary for children born in these circles. they are eased into it, really young. The father of the king, Prince Claus, was also a pedophile, often hooked up with court attorney Solomon's son and engaged in violent orgies with minors, confirmed by multiple sources and one insider. In fact, Prince Claus once got caught by NYPD during one of his official visits. Ministers and state secretaries in total panic. Something the Dutch state has been blackmailed due to Prince Claus' escapades for decades. Just as the Dutch state has been blackmailed with the Turkish case against Demik to detain Baybeyzid for life. There is a suspicion that the same has happened with the evidence of the sexual escapades of Prince Claus. Blackmail with compromising images is simply as effective. It's simply an effective way to exert political pressure. So why wouldn't this have happened to the royal family? This is the likely reason that no biography of Claus has yet been published. Of course, there's also the version that Prince Claus and Demik were recorded on video on pedophilia activity, abusing children at the Apollo yacht in the Sandburg child porn case. Marcel Verblossom has been working for years to expose the European child trafficking networks. In anticipation of the case, Verblossom already can foresee a fact of which he is 100% certain. According to his research, more than 100,000 children have been abused in the Sandburg case. This Apollo, code word, is Demik's secret file and falls under state security in the Netherlands. The Apollo boat was used to offer young people an internship to learn how to sail. Verblossom also knows that Prince Claus sailed on that boat. The so-called offering of an internship or workplace in order to recruit young people for sexual abuse is also fully in line with the witness statement Van Blichenburg about another case in which children who supposedly came to work at Beatrix Palace subsequently disappeared from the face of the earth. A lot of this was translated, not only from Spanish to English, but from Dutch to English. A lot of this information I just couldn't find in English. And, you know, it makes me think that maybe with other cases, like the Madeleine McCann case, or the John of Gat case, I don't know how to talk or read or anything Portuguese. I mean, local news is always the best source of information. So I wanted to include this story just to seal up the importance of the region of Bariloche in Argentina for the Dutch royalty and the Nazi regime. Last tango in Bariloche. The Oranges and Soriguetas have known each other for generations. Prince Bernhard met the Soriguetas before the Second World War. He regularly visited Argentina, including the holiday resort of Bariloche, where both the Soriguetas and the Oranges have a holiday home. This area was also, by chance, the region to which many Nazi officers fled after the war in order to escape a conviction during the Nuremberg trials. Maxima, Jorge Soriguieta, William Alexander, Prince Bernhard, they all liked to come to San Carlos de Bariloche, the Czech Argentinian winter sports paradise. However, there is also a shadow side to this Bavaria at the foot of the Andes. The Bariloche area was a kind of Swiss-German enclave in Argentina. Images of the wooden alpine houses in the Argentine mountains could easily be confused with those from the Alps. The Soriguetas had a holiday home in the Cerro Catedral, and Maxima spent an important part of her childhood in that location. Both Maxima and William Alexander are of German blood and share the same ancestor, Peter Halbach, who lived from 1634 to 1686, a landlord from the German town of Kratenhol. The aristocratic Halbach family settled in South America in the early 19th century throughout Franz Halbach, the Prussian ambassador to Argentina. If DNA testing confirms this genetic origin, it would mean that they are distant family members of each other. Jorge Soriguieta had a holiday home in the Cerro Catedral. Until 1996, the year in which a large fire, whose traces are still visible, destroyed a large part of the buildings, and Jorge Zorrilleta sold the site. A neighbor remembers the family well, even though she never had direct contact because the Zorrilleta family was far too high for that. Always romping with the boys, Maxima, said the neighbor. A wonderful girl, very good that she will be queen of the Netherlands. Good for the fraternization of her peoples. At the time that the Zorrilleta family came skiing every year in the Cerro Catedral, the instructors present were strictly German speakers. Bariloche and the surrounding area were even more exclusive than they are now. It emphasized the germophilic traits of the Zorriguetas, whose daughter was raised by German nuns in primary school in Buenos Aires. Also, in San Carlos de Bariloche, 15 kilometers away, with a population of 80,000, a metropolis according to Patagonian standards, on top of the Cerro Oro, the mountain located above the city, is the Berghof, Bariloche's prominent resident Otto Mayling, a Bavarian alpinist who acted as a ski instructor for the legendary dictator Juan Domingo Perón, lived in the alpine hut there until his death in 1989. Mayling's Berghof is now a museum and is still in good condition. A poem carved in a wooden leaf says something about the philosophy of this legendary mountain man. Come with us on the mountain, comrade. High we will rise, up from hope and deed, close the dance. Mayling came to Bariloche in the early 1930s. He was one of the driving forces behind the Hitler Youth in Argentina, which was able to operate without interruption until the late 1930s. In 1931, together with four other German immigrants, Mayling was a co-founder of the Club Andino Bariloche, or CAB, an association for organized snow fun, in reality, a mantle organization for virulent pan-Germanic intelligence work in Patagonia. The German agitation in Bariloche was already quite manifest in the 1930s. At the top of the building of the German language school Primo Caparo, the name of an Italian fascist who had settled in Bariloche as well, the swastika flag fluttered and the German-born teachers were obligated to join the League of National Socialist Teachers. Hitler's Mein Kampf was the most important exercise book. In 1938, the elected Argentina president, Roberto Ortiz, put an end to this anti-Argentinian activities, quote. The institute was dissolved after the World War II. Once dictator Perón had taken office, to be reestablished by Nazis who had fled to Bariloche. Downstairs, in the tourist town itself, one feels just as much in Teutonic atmospheres. The houses and shops, architecturally, do not differ in any way from the Germanic model. The most important export product of the town is chocolate. The stove of the Weiss family serves smoked red deer and mulled wine. In the establishments Der Biergarten, El Viejo Munich, and La Alpina, you'll find a variety of German beers. The Hotel Edelweiss, Pirker and Wichter contribute to Bariloche's name as the Bavaria of Argentina. The district of Belgrano contains so many German migrants that it is properly called El Barrio Alemán, or the German Hood. Only the Essenes in the square in the center of Bariloche, where a furious crowd has gathered and throwing stones at the tall. San Carlos de Bariloche was founded in 1902 by the German consul in Chile, Carlos Widerholt. Nowadays accounts for an annual profit of $300 million a year. The town of Bariloche grew, slowly but surely. When the Argentinian government stated that they needed to put a stop to the espionage activities of the German government in Bariloche, politician Silvano Santander accused Prince Schaumburg-sur-Lippe and the Lahusen brothers of providing the Third Reich with Hunt and Hunts. By the Activity Commission of Anti-Argentine Activities of the Parliament in Buenos Aires, which, however, had to cease its activities 2 years later at the insistence of the Nazi-friendly Perón. After World War II, the influx of German immigrants to Argentina could not be stopped, and it only increased. Patagonia was by far the most popular travel destination because once you got there, it was hardly traceable. This was already experienced by American gangsters Robert Leroy Parker and Harry Longebaugh, better known as Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, who after having robbed the First National Bank of Winnemucca, Nevada in 1900, found a safe refuge in Cholila near El Bolsón, about 120 kilometers south of Bariloche. Even the fanatical crook hunters of the Pinkerton Detective Agency could no longer find him there. They could have spent their days in Patagonia unhindered, but unfortunately greed could do more for them, and they attempted to take over the mine in Bolivia, and the attempt was fatal. They didn't survive. Juan Perón started his term as president of Argentina in 1945, 3 weeks before the Germans surrender. He declared the war on the Axis powers, but that was only for the form, for show, a diplomatic gesture towards the Americans and the British. In practice, Perón, who in the 1930s was an Argentinian ambassador to Mussolini's Italy, had been greatly impressed, supported the Nazis whatever he could. According to a statement by his advisor, Pedro Bianchi, in 1979, Perón sold 2,000 passports and 8,000 blank identity cards to Nazi circles in Europe in his first term alone at the Casa Rosada in Buenos Aires. It is rumored that Perón earned around $6 million from that business. Between 1945 and 1955, an estimated 80,000 Germans, Austrians, and Croatians started a new life in Argentina. About 15,000 of them did so with false identity cards, which gives a careful indication of the Nazi population in Perón's Argentina. Evita Duarte Perón was also personally involved with the so-called rat lines. To this end, the Argentinian First Lady toured Europe in the summer of 1947, visiting Francisco Franco in Spain, Pope Pius XII, and representatives of the Swiss government, among others. A secret migration agency was set up in Bern, Switzerland, led by the former SS Karl Follner. A flight to the Pampas cost the traveler, including adjusted proof of identity, about $50,000. Less wealthy fugitives had to make do with a trip on one of the many ships of Uruguayan shipping company Alberto Dodero, a personal friend of the Perón couple. This flow of immigration did not go unnoticed by San Carlos de Bariloche either. Journalist Abel Basti of the local newspaper South Morning made it his life's work to map the Nazi population of his hometown. He did this in numerous reports for his newspaper, which often led to national news, and in a yet-unpublished tourist guide for Nazi locations in Bariloche. Priebke arrived in Argentina by boat in 1948 with a passport of the Red Cross in the name of Otto Papp. He settled with his wife and two children in Bariloche. There he became the manager of a delicatessen specializing in a smoked ham. He soon felt so safe that he used his own name again, which many fledged Nazis in Argentina used to do. The former SS had just planned to retire to an estate that he had purchased just outside of Bariloche when the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Vienna got notice of his location. In 1994, Nazi hunter Rick Eaton settled in Bariloche in search of the still very active Nazi propagandist Reinhard Kops, as known as Juan Mahler. Kops Mahler was born in Hamburg in 1914 and was a secret agent. He was a secret agent of the Nazis during the Second World War in Albania. In 1948, he fled to Argentina, where he was the publisher and editor of the neo-Nazi struggle Der Weg in Germany in the 1950s. In Bariloche, he was the manager of Hotel Campana, in Bariloche's German hood. The agent gained confidence by posing as a millionaire willing to donate a lot of money to the international neo-Nazi movement during a meeting at Hotel Edelweiss in Bariloche. cops said that the money would be donated to various underground cells in Germany. These statements were recorded on a tape and played in CNN's hands. Once confronted by a reporter from the American News Channel, Cops broke. "I'm just a small cock in the organization," he exclaimed. "Why don't you go after the brain? Why don't you go catch Priebke?" This is how the court team fell on Rome's executioner. At the request of the Italian judiciary, he was arrested, and in November 1995, the Supreme Court of Argentina decided to extradite him by 3-2. In Bariloche, that led to some indignant reactions, says Abel Basti. Priebke, also known as Uncle Eric, was a welcoming figure, especially in the better circles of this city. Many saw him live with sad eyes. The great international publicity surrounding the Priebke case was the reason for the then Argentinian government, led by President Carlos Menem, to set up a special committee to chart the activities of Nazis in Argentina. This Comisión de Esclarecimiento de las Actividades Nazis en Argentina delivered a reasonably well-considered piece of work in 1999, although it was expressly wary of addressing the dominance of the numerous surviving Argentinian entrepreneurs with Nazi relationships. In addition, Menem had a center against racism and discrimination established in Bariloche. The National Institute Against Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Racism no longer exists. It was closed in 2002. It was no more than a public relations stunt, primarily intended for consumption abroad. For Basti, the Priebke case was a good reason to exhaustively chart the Nazi connections in his hometown. When possible, he also visited the man in question for an interview. Josef Mengele, the angel of death of Auschwitz, is said to have lived in the Barrio Alemán for several years. According to Basti's research, in 1948 or 1949, Mengele even obtained his driver's license in Bariloche. A former municipal official told the reporter, "Mengele would return to Bariloche several times for vacations, where he would be a welcome guest on the estancia of the wealthy." Simon Wiesenthal stated that the former camp doctor was recognized in Bariloche in February 1960 by then 48-year-old Israeli tourist Nora Eldock, who was a survivor of Auschwitz and was personally sterilized by Mengele. Eldock met Mengele during a party in a hotel. For a few seconds, she stood face to face with him, after which she quickly left the hotel and warned the police. A few days later, on February 12, 1960, the body of the woman was found in a cave in the mountains outside of Bariloche. The finder was the Slovenian mountaineer Boško Arko, the friend and biographer of Berghof resident Otto Meiling. He said to Basti that he believed that the dead woman was an agent of the Mossad. The Austrian Adolf Eichmann was also reported to have been spotted in Bariloche in 1956, when an Israeli secret agent of the Mossad, who only became known as B.A., settled in a cafe by Lake Nawawapi and heard a group speak in German. One of these men talked with some authority about his collection of Austrian stamps. When B.A. arrived to Buenos Aires and found a photo of the wanted criminal in a newspaper, he recognized the man. All this would eventually lead to the abduction of Eichmann in 1960 by a group of Israeli Secret Service agents in Eichmann's hometown of Buenos Aires. In the book based on conversations with Eichmann's confidant, William Sassen, The Fatal Friendships of Adolf Eichmann, of the Belgian Stan Lorenz. Intriguing in Basti's guide is also the story that Hitler's deputy, Martin Bormann, would have stayed in Bariloche. The Italian magazine Tempo reported having found a tombstone with the inscription M. Bormann in 1960. Shortly thereafter, this grave appeared to have disappeared. Bormann officially died in May 1945 in Berlin. According to Basti, the Weissführer lived undisturbed in Patagonia under the name of Ricardo Bauer, where he was still being photographed by a local beauty. Basti added, I think there is enough reason to investigate, but even the Wiesenthal Center does not want it. A certain Nazi fatigue has arisen. According to the journalists, immediately after the German capitulation, the vast deserted coast of Patagonia was visited many times by German submarines who transferred the stolen treasures of the Third Reich plus the surviving leaders to what should be the Fourth Reich. U-boats visited the Patagonian coast many times before and after the German capitulation. It's confirmed by many reports from the Argentine Navy. Years after the war, people in the hinterland of Patagonia reported that they had seen German U-boats. A few years ago, I spoke to a captain of the Argentine Navy who had participated in the war with the British for the Falklands. Horst Fultner played a crucial role, along with Priebke, founder of the Cultural Association of German-Argentine Culture in Bariloche. Fultner was sentenced in absentia by the Nuremberg Tribunal. In Argentina, he held a senior advisory role with the first government of Perón. In Córdoba, north of Buenos Aires, he founded the Fultner Bank. The Nazi activity in this province could be called large before the Second World War. The Eichhorn brothers, for example, drove the huge, internationally renowned Hotel Eden in the village of La Falda. The Eichhorns were Hitler fans from the first hour. In Córdoba, Tank of Perón was given his own factory, Aeronautical Institute of Córdoba, where he designed, among other things, the Pulque II, the supersonic fighter plane that the engineer donated to Juan Perón's New Argentina, and what became the pride of the Argentinian Air Force. As a test pilot, Tank took Hans Ulrich from Germany. In Bariloche, both Fultner and Rudel were registered as members of the club Andino Bariloche. From Argentina, former colonel of the Luftwaffe, Rudel, in 1952, once again took the lead in the Bundestag elections in Germany on behalf of the Deutsche Reichspartei. But the German government stopped doing so because of its membership of the NSDAP. One of the first non-Argentinians to admire the Polke II with their own eyes was actually Prince Bernhard of Netherlands on his legendary tour of South America in 1951. On April 3 that year, Bernhard was the goodwill ambassador of Dutch business in Buenos Aires after visiting Rio de Janeiro and Uruguay first. It was Bernhard's task to cultivate the land for Dutch trade in Argentina. As a translator during the Prince's conversations with the Perons, the Dutch SS Willem Sassen, former editor-in-chief of the Telegraph in 1944 and working in Argentina as a PR advisor and translator of the Peron couple. Via Sassen, war criminal Klaus Barbie would also have access to the Prince in Argentina. However, that led to some consternation much later, when the weekly The Tich published an article on 1984. The official deployment of Bernhard's mission in Argentina was a $1 million order for the Dutch Work Track, which had been trying to secure an Argentinian assignment since 1936. The Argentinian rail network had traditionally been built with British expertise and materials, but it had come to the attention of Dutch entrepreneurs that Perón wanted to break with that tradition. This was due to the fact that his wife was not welcoming England during her major European tour in 1947. The construction of the Argentinian rail network was now the subject of open registration, so Bernhard arrived in Buenos Aires with a procession of entrepreneurs by Fokker Friendship, with the Grand Cross in the Order of Orange Nassau for Evita. Even after the rail network was finished and financed, that didn't end Bernhard's mission in Argentina. In Buenos Aires, he was received at a demonstration of the Polke II. Both Bernhard and his pilot, Gerben Sondermann, were particularly impressed, writes Bernhard's secretary F.A. the graph. However, there was another fruit of German-Argentine cooperation that interested Bernhardt even more, and which would lead him to San Carlos de Bariloche. It is an episode that has so far been underexposed in the Netherlands, but which has already been studied and described in detail in Argentina by the renowned physicist Mario A.J. Mariscotti of the University of Buenos Aires in his book The Atomic Secret, 1996. On the day that Bernhardt began his journey to South America in 1951, Juan Perón announced at a spectacular press conference that Argentina had developed its own process for developing nuclear energy through a controlled process of thermonuclear fusion. All this, Perón explained, was due to his atomic scholar Ronald Richter, who had built a nuclear reactor in the deepest secrecy a year earlier on the island of Huemul, in Lake Nahuelhuapi, near Bariloche. The Argentine atomic plans was a concern in the international relations for several years. Ronald Richter was a big unknown in the international scientific environment. The responses to Perón's announcement were therefore skeptical. Mariscotti writes that Richter, a native Austrian, worked in 1942 and 43 in a private laboratory of Baron Manfred van Aerden in Berlin. Richter received his own laboratory within the Kurt Tank workshop in Cordoba. Tank had already made the dictator comfortable with the prospect of developing an atomic submarine, so that Perón thought he could hit two birds with one stone. However, in 1949, Richter refused to continue working in Cordoba. There had been a fire in his laboratory, presumably due to a short circuit, but Richter immediately thought of sabotage and threatened to leave for America. The atomic scientist demanded his own autonomous workplace, where his secret could be well preserved. The choice fell on the island of Huemul, 7 kilometers outside of Bariloche. Bariloche was then a small village. The rest of the area was totally depopulated. The Nahuelhuapi area had already been declared a protected reserve in the 1920s, as a result of which the residents were all rigorously expropriated and sent away. Richter was able to work on his top secret project in peace. In March 1950, Richter, now an Argentinian citizen, settled in Bariloche. Under his supervision, 400 soldiers, electricians, and carpenters worked on the construction of the laboratory and the reactor. Richter had received carte blanche from Juan and Evita Perón, who quickly visited him that year. Even before the exposure of Richter took place, Bernhardt came to Bariloche at the end of March 1951 at the invitation of Perón himself. He settled in the exclusive Lao Lao Hotel, which was entirely at the disposal of the Dutch delegation. The prince stayed 3 days before traveling back to the Netherlands. Bernhardt clearly couldn't go wrong with Perón. The prince, in turn, was very impressed by this part of Patagonia, where he would return year after year for vacations. In August 1999, Willem Alexander introduced himself to his future in-laws in the same hotel, Lao Lao, another typical example of Patagonian and Tyrolean architecture. The first photos of William Alexander and Maxima that appear in the Argentinian press were also taken in the mountains of Bariloche. So you see, this fantasy that Maxima and William Alexander didn't know each other, or that Maxima didn't know that he was a prince, I think that's pretty much, you know, impossible. Considering their family history and their links, these are families that are basically destined to be together since before they were born. These friendships are not in vain. These relationships, these cooperations throughout history, throughout decades, is what happens worldwide with these global elites. They have been helping each other, scratching each other's back, for centuries, for even millennia. So I just want to leave you to finish this long episode in which we covered basically the whole fascist and Nazi history of Argentina and how the Netherlands ties into that, and the Vatican, of course, with the last words of the thesis that Inés Orrieta, sister of Queen Máxima, wrote. As you probably know, as we mentioned in episode 1, she made her thesis about suicide and how to tackle that problem. Her last words go as follow: maybe in coordination with states and independent entities, you could establish a plan of action that helps to prevent the act that goes against the very main principle of life, to understand it and to cure it like it deserves. Rest in peace, Inés Orrieta. Rest in peace.